Okay, George, you're good to go.
Very good. This is lesson four, the fourth lesson in a series of five, technician licensing class presented by the Arlington Public Radio, Arlington Public Service Club in Arlington, Virginia. My name is George Arthur. I'll be moderating the lessons tonight. And I'll go ahead and jump right into the first slide. We've got quite a few slides to get through tonight, and not a lot of time to do it. Dave likes to have these run these things in about one-hour chunks so that everybody doesn't get too dazed and confused. So we'll move right along. We're going to go into the, first of all, just a quick quiz for sub-elements T6 and T7. First of all, does anyone know what RST? The question is, what does RST mean in a signal report? A, recovery, signal strength, tempo. B, recovery, signal speed, tone. C, readability, signal speed, tempo. And D, readability, signal strength, tone. Any guesses? Want me to go over those again? Any hands? Okay, the answer is D, readability, signal strength, tone, RST. Next question, from section T6A, what is meant by the term DX? Best regards, that's A, B is distant station, C is calling any station, and D is go ahead.
Distant station.
Distant station, very good, Desiree. I wish I had one of those bells like they have on a front desk to hit that. Very good. Next question. This is from section T6B. What is the name given to an amateur radio station that is used to connect to other amateur radio stations with the internet? A, a gateway. B, a repeater. C, a digipeater. And D, FCC regulations prohibit such a station.
It's one of the first two.
A is gateway and B is repeater. This is a gateway. And gateway is the name given to an amateur radio station used to connect other amateur stations with the internet. All right. We don't ask too many of these tonight. Section C. Jump to section C. What effect might a break in a cable television transmission line have on amateur communications? A, cable lines are shielded and a break cannot affect amateur communications. B, harmonic radiation from the TV receiver may cause the amateur transmitter to transmit off frequency. C, TV interference may result when the amateur station is transmitting, or interference may occur to the amateur receiver. And D, the broken cable may pick up very high voltages when the amateur station is transmitting. I know that's kind of a hairy dog to have to keep in your head. The answer is C. What effect might a break in a television transmission line have on amateur communications? TV interference may result when the amateur station is transmitting, or interference may occur to the amateur receiver. Let's see. We'll just do another quick one of these. T7. A. What is the basic unit of electrical power? A. The ohm. B. The watt. C. The volt. And D. The ampere. What is the basic unit of electrical power? The answer...
Oh, I was going to... I just don't remember. It's either the ohm or the ampere.
Okay. You're in the ballpark. The ampere is a measure of current, electrical current.
Okay.
The correct answer here is the watt. Just think of electrical power. How much power in a light bulb is measured in watts, 100 watt bulb.
Oh, okay.
What is the basic unit of resistance? A, the volt. B, the watt. C, the ampere. D, the ohm.
That would be the ohm.
That would be the ohm. Very good. And finally, how many hertz are in a kilohertz?
1,000.
1,000. I didn't have to give you that. The answer C. Very good. How many cans of soda are in a six pack? Desiree, I think you got it again. All right. Good. We're going to start good engineering practice. We've just got a couple of slides here that are titled, so I'll jump through them real fast in case this is driving your dial-up line crazy. We're going to start with the slide that's entitled Basic Station. And it's basically four blocks and an antenna and some interconnections. In the lower left-hand corner, you've got a power supply. Typically, ham radio gear runs on 12 volts DC. There are a number of reasons for this. Power supply, and many times you'll have, one power supply typically will feed the transmitter and the receiver. Between the transmitter and the receiver sits something called a TR switch, which is short for transmit-receive switch. You have to have a way to switch the antenna between the transmitter and receiver. You can't connect the antenna to the same all the time, to both of them all the time, because if you hit your transmitter, which puts out many watts, you would just blow the stuffing out of your receiver. Your receiver is a very, very sensitive piece of electronic gear. It listens for thousandths and millionths of a volt. So the receiver would just blow the transmitter would blow the receiver out of the water. So you have to have some way to switch the antenna back and forth so that the transmitted power does not get into the receiver while you're transmitting. And also, typically, the receiver is actually disabled electronically during transmit. Next slide. This one is entitled Simple Continuous Wave Transmitter, or CW. And we have another batch of blocks here. Block number one is what they want you to concentrate on. Block number one is what controls the frequency of the station. And if it is a crystal, a piezoelectric crystal, the station is referred to as being crystal-controlled, a crystal-controlled transmitter. If block one is a variable frequency oscillator, a VFO, it's referred to as a VFO control transmitter. And the whole shebang is controlled by the key. The key turns the output, the power amplifier, and probably the driver off and on. When you push down a telegraph key, it turns on the transmitter, transmits a pure tone. When you let up on the key, the tone ceases. So that's all you're doing is transmitting a pure tone. I'm going on to the next slide, and if I'm rushing, feel free to jump in and ask a question. It's okay. It's just I'm trying to get through a bunch of slides quickly, but I don't want to go so. But my job here is to teach you what's going on. So if I'm going through too quickly, by all means, stop me. This slide is entitled Frequency Modulation, or FM. And if you look at graphic A, you'll see, and unfortunately this looked better as a PowerPoint slide, and when it was rendered into HTML, it kind of messed this up. But it should be a smooth wave going up and down, up and down, up and down. And you will notice that the wave, the up and down part, is equally spaced. And it's also, they're all of equal height. Equally spaced means that the waves are all of the same frequency. Equal height means they are all of the same amplitude or power. Now, the second graphic, the wave shape of the modulating signal, that is the information that you need to transmit. That might be coming from a microphone, say. It might be a voice signal. Somehow, you have to impose the information contained in graphic B onto the carrier in graphic A. And in an FM scheme, it would look like graphic C. And if you notice, when the signal in B drops below the center line there, the frequency in the modulated carrier in C drops, and that's shown by the up and down part being farther apart. There are fewer cycles there, so it has slowed down the frequency. Conversely, when there's a peak above the center line in B, the tall peak, not the bottom peak, top peak, it speeds up the carrier slightly. So what you're doing is you're using the crests and valleys in the signal that contains the information to affect and change the carrier in such a way that you impose that information on the carrier. And so your carrier carries the information. That's why it's called a carrier wave. You have changed it somehow. And the carrier, of course, is the frequency that you're transmitting on. Next slide. Now we have a few on FM transmitters and such. This is an FM transmitter, and there are several different ways they can draw these and include some boxes and leave a few out, but this one has, they're concentrating on block one. And block one is the box where the modulation that we just discussed takes place. We have the oscillator, which provides the carrier frequency coming up from the bottom to block one. We have the information signal that we need to impose in the carrier frequency coming from the microphone through the audio amp and the clipper filter. It's important that you don't over-modulate on FM, or you can drive your frequency into adjacent channels. The information signal from the left and the carrier from the bottom are combined. The information modulates the carrier, and you get a modulated carrier going through the multipliers through the power amp so that you can get out past your front yard and finally to the antenna. The next slide is another FM transmitter slide, and it says that the audio amplifier, which is the first box past the microphone, and this FM transmitter failed, the output would be an unmodulated carrier. And why is that? If you go over to your reactance modulator, remember that we are taking a pure signal from the oscillator that supplies your carrier, and we're combining that with information from the microphone in the form of an electrical signal that corresponds to your speaking voice. If there's nothing coming into the reactance oscillator from the microphone, then the reactance modulator is going to just pass that unmodulated carrier right through, and you'll just be transmitting a silent carrier wave. Our next slide is frequency modulation. And here are just some characteristics of FM. FM transmitters operate at full power at all times, even with no audio output, so they're not particularly efficient in that sense. When an FM transmitter overmodulates, when we change the frequency of the carrier too much, we shove that carrier up or down in frequency so much so we can intrude into adjacent channels, and that makes people mad. So you have to be careful about that. It's overmodulation, and the correct term for this is actually over-deviation. The FM modulation process is called deviation. And FM, as you know, is less affected by FM noise because the wave, if there's any amplitude, additional amplitude introduced into the signal. If you remember on the slide a couple of the slides back, the FM carrier was just flat on the top and the bottom. Well, if it were not flat, if it went a little above or below that, in the receiver, it just chops that stuff off, because that's the stuff that constitutes noise, and that's where your noise goes. So FM, in fact, was developed during the Second World War by a fellow named Armstrong, and it gave us a real edge there for a while. Because our communications, our soldiers used it. Our next slide is simple CW and SSB, or single sideband receiver. And it says here the mixer shifts the received frequency to an intermediate frequency for processing. The IF amplifier adds gain and filtering. Many receivers have several IF filters of different bandwidths because some emission types need a wider bandwidth than others, okay? And the product detector mixes the IF with the beat frequency oscillator, BFO, restores the carrier, and recovers the audio. Okay. The mixer... Yeah, we can talk about the mixer here a little bit. A mixer is not a mixer, it looks like you've got an oscillator pointing to it, and so you might think it's kind of like a modulator and a transmitter. It's not exactly. It's a cousin of a modulator. A mixer is a kind of an odd duck because it takes the frequency, the signal you want to hear in from the antenna, and mixes that with a locally generated frequency that's from the local oscillator, from the local oscillator, just call the oscillator here, and the product of this is two new frequencies. The sum and the difference of the frequency you want to hear off the air and the oscillator frequency. So you'll have, if you have A coming in from one and B coming in from the other, you'll have A plus B and A minus B. The idea with the intermediate frequency amplifier is that of these four frequencies, it only takes the intermediate frequency, which in an FM or SSB receiver, I believe, is typically 10.7 megahertz. It ignores the others, just filters those out. So you'll go into the product detector, and finally where the signal is further processed, all the RF is gone from there, and after that you just have the audio signal that goes to the loudspeaker. We have a series of three FM receiver slides now. Let's see, the IF amplifier and limiter remove unwanted amplitude variation, right, because you want this thing very flat. The discriminator recovers the modulation signal from the frequency modulated IF signal, okay, just as in our last slide. If a receiver contains a discriminator, it's an FM receiver, and if the discriminator fails, there is no audio output. Well, heck, almost anything in this thing failed, you'd have no audio output. It's all in series. Slide 2. Now, this one puzzles me a bit. I didn't put these slides together. I've been looking at this one and trying to figure out just what they're trying to get across here. And my best guess is that they are, they're talking about the mixer again. The mixer is going to receive, again, it'll receive the signal off the air from the antenna from the left. It will also receive the signal, the frequency from the local oscillator, the blue squiggle on the bottom. And it'll produce, and out of that, you'll get both the local oscillator frequency, the input frequency from the antenna, the addition of those two, and the difference of those two. Now, an interesting corollary to this is that you could have two different frequencies. You could have the 14.0 or the 168.4. So I believe what they're suggesting is that you have to have a filter. You can't have a broadband RF amplifier before the mixer. You have to have a filter that will remove the frequencies off the air that you don't want to have go into your mixer, and that will eliminate the unwanted other frequency here. Anyway, that's my best guess. Slide 3. Now, every time you have an IF amplifier stage, that's a conversion stage. You're converting from a very, usually a very high frequency down to something that's more, that's easier to handle by the receiver. In almost all communications gear, if, especially the stuff that works at many megahertz or even gigahertz, it's very difficult and expensive to process RF, radio frequency signals, at that frequency. And they're just real tricky. So what they do is they down-convert them just as quickly as they can to a much lower frequency. Sometimes they do it in one, in two or three different stages. That would be a single, double, or triple conversion receiver. And there are advantages to doing this as far as eliminating signals that are off frequency that might sort of sneak through an electronic back door in the chain that you'd hear, even though they're not on the frequency you want to hear. An FM receiver has a squelch control, which should be set to the point just where it silences background noise. If you've ever used a 2-meter rig, you know that you've got a lot of that noise in the background. And what you do is you turn up this knob, mark squelch, until that background noise just disappears. What you're doing is you're telling the amplifier inside, if the audio level goes above this point, then I want to hear it. That would suggest that somebody's talking. Below that, it's probably noise. I don't want to hear it. And you don't have to have an ear full of hiss the whole time. The next slide is entitled Receivers. Detection is the process of recovering information from modulated carrier wave. Okay. We talked about transmitters. When we imposed information on a signal, on a carrier wave, we call that what? Anybody? Remember?
Modulation.
Modulation, right. The analog to modulation for pulling the information back off the carrier wave in the receiver is called detection. They're opposites. Detection is the process of recovering the information from a modulated carrier wave. All receivers have a detector circuit function. In the CW-SSB receiver, it's a product detector. In the FM receiver, it's called a discriminator. And if you want to check the United States runs a series of very, very accurate transmitters, WWV, WWVH. I believe WWVH is in Hawaii. And you can check a number of different things. The signal is not only extremely pure on frequency, they also transmit timing signals that are of a particular length. And there's a lot of information, very accurate information you can get from their transmissions. They also transmit the weather to ships at sea, which is kind of nice. Our next slide, which is kind of a bonus, the VHF-UHF multimode receiver, which are black boxes which you can trade for a large amount of money, and they will tune FM. They tune all kinds of different modulation types, AM, single sideband, CW, what have you. And it says here, these transceivers are well suited for weak signal communications work, but boy, are they expensive. Our next slide is called Data Communications Packet. And I'll go through these quickly and then go back and dwell on just one of these bullets. Packet uses a terminal node controller, or TNC, to interface a computer and a transceiver. And if you look at the block diagram, you've got a computer, a TNC, and a transceiver. Okay. And between the computer and the TNC, you typically have at least the last time I did anything with it, you typically have a serial connection. A TNC breaks the data to be transmitted into packets, which include error-checking information. I'll talk more about that in a moment. On VHF, an FM transceiver may be used for packet. Okay. And the final one, okay, won't worry about that. That's kind of trivial. The TNC breaks the data to be transmitted into packets, which include error-checking information. Well, that's true, but there's more to it than that. It doesn't just chop it into pieces. It actually chops it into particular length. It takes the data stream coming in, chops the data stream into parts, into pieces of a certain number of bits long, and then it packages them. That's what a packet is. A packet is a kind of a carrier. It puts some bits in front and maybe some bits behind that tell something about the data that is embedded in this packet. And that's what the internet is. It's just a giant packet switching network. And everything going over the internet is packets. At the other end, your computer, for example, receives the packet, goes into the packet, and pulls out the data, and then seamlessly splices that data back together into the original data stream and sends it on. And it's all done very quickly, and it's really a marvelous thing. But there's some stuff, there's some information called in what's called a header, which is some additional information in the packet that tells some useful stuff about the payload, that the piece of data that is enclosed in the packet. And typically, one of the things you'd have would be a sequence number. When you chop these things up, at least on the internet, when you chop these, you're sending a song over the internet, you chop the pieces up and send them out in packets, they may go by different routes and arrive out of order at the other end. And there has to be some way that the receiving computer can look at these packets and figure out which way to splice them back together. Otherwise, the parts would be all mixed up. And to some extent, you have that with amateur packet communications as well. While this would all be in real time, you might have a packet that did not get through, or there was some noise or something, it got damaged, or somehow or other it needed to be resent. So the computer at the far end can, the TNC at the far end can say, oh, this is a bad packet, or it's somehow invalid, resend it. And the transmitter will resend that, and then it will drop that packet into the stream in the correct order. It'll drop the data carried in the packet into the stream in the direct order, and it'll splice that data stream together, and you're good to go. Data communications, RTTY, which is an old abbreviation for radio teletype. Not a lot of radio teletype anymore, I don't think, because it has no error correction. It's just kind of a brute force way of sending characters over radio. But it still works. Some people still use it. And since it has no error correction, they just chug right along. They send it, and if you miss something, then you try and figure out what it said from the context. Station accessories. This is another slide that has information that we... power supply converts 120 volts, at least in the United States, AC, 12 volts DC, and is necessary to run a mobile transceiver from house power. Well, sure. Or you could have a 12-volt battery under your desk that could work, and that would be very useful if you were in an emergency situation. A microphone must be connected to a transceiver for voice operation, certainly. A telegraph key is needed for CW operation. That's the, you've seen them on TV. An electronic key is an embellishment of a basic telegraph key. Instead of the dots and dashes, dits and dots being made by the mechanical closure and opening of the contacts on the mechanical key, the electronic key makes dots and dashes electronically. And they typically have a paddle which you move sideways to one side to make dits, to the other side to make dots. And you can, some of these guys who are really good at this can really go. A dummy antenna is a handy thing to have around your shack in case you want to test a transmitter and you don't want to transmit your test signals and annoy all the hams in the area. And of course, if you are, what it does is just a big resistor. And so if you are transmitting 100 watts and putting 100 watts into your dummy load, of course you'd want one that would take 100 watts, or maybe you end up with a lot of smoke in your shack. Next slide, more station accessories. Now the first bullet says a diplexer. Originally said a duplexer, and I changed it to diplexer, and there's still, I talked to Dave Jordan about this, and there's still some confusion about that. He agrees with me a diplexer is probably the right term, but I hear both used. To me, a diplexer is used when you have a multi-band transceiver and with multiple ports on the back, multiple antenna connectors, and you want to connect two or more of those to a single antenna that maybe is multiband antenna. You'd have a gadget called diplexer, whereas a duplexer is separates frequencies within the same band. You have to have a duplexer at a repeater in order to separate the transmit and receive frequencies when you're using the same antenna so that your transmit power doesn't go into your receiver. A power amplifier may be useful to boost the low power output from a handheld transceiver up to 100 watts. And an SWR, or standing wave ratio meter, is also a useful item to see how well your antenna is functioning. You connect it in your feed line between your transceiver or your transmitter and your antenna, or your antenna switch if you have one. And you can, when you transmit, you'll see what your standing wave ratio is, and we'll get into that. A few slides along. The next slide is entitled Station Layout. And there are three boxes. Box one is transceiver, two is antenna switch, and three is dummy antenna. And the antenna switch just lets you say you're working on this transmitter. If you select A, you will have selected an antenna. If you select B, you have selected box 3, which is the dummy antenna. And if you select C, you'll probably burn up your transmitter because you've got no load on it, and that would be bad. So you don't want to do that. Never run a transceiver without a load on it. Station layout. Again, we have a transceiver, but now we have an SWR, standing wave ratio meter, and an antenna tuner. We know about the SWR meter. The antenna tuner, an antenna is only resonant in usually on a particular band or a series of bands that are related harmonically. An antenna might work well on 14 megahertz and also might work well on 28 megahertz because that's an integral multiple. Or it might also work well on 7. But if you tried to go in between those frequencies, not that you could legally, but if you tried to transmit, say, on 10, you'd find your antenna would be a bad impedance match for your transmitter, and you might burn something out. The antenna tuner allows you to use an antenna that would not natively work in the part of the band that you want it to work in, but it matches the transceiver up to it anyway. It has the port on the left side of box 3 would be probably 52 ohms, typical standard coaxial impedance, and the impedance on the right would be whatever the antenna was presenting at that particular frequency. So it's a handy thing to have. Typically, antenna tuners, I think these days, are built in to many of the better transceivers. coaxial cable. Three kinds of coaxial cable here. You notice the top one is just basic with a, you've got a center conductor, and then just to the right of that, there's some white stuff. That's typically a foam, it's called dielectric, it's an insulator. Over that, you have a braid, which is connected to ground, and then over that, you have a black cover, which keeps out the dirt and moisture and so forth. The middle coaxial cable is double shielded with two layers of braid, and the third one down apparently has some copper foil with braid over that. The more shielding you have, typically the more expensive the cable is. Now, why do they call it coax? Well, you've got an inner conductor, and then around that in a circular pattern, is with the same, on the same axis though, centered on the center conductor, you have your insulation. Then over that, again, centered on the center conductor, you have your braid and so forth. So they are all using the same center. They are co-centered. They're using the same axis. They are coaxial. So that's what coaxial, they call it coaxial cable. Next slide. Not much of this used anymore. This is parallel conductor feed line, and it was used a lot more in the early days of amateur radio because it's very efficient. Using air for insulating your antenna, of course this has these spacers, but mostly it's more air than spacer here. Using air to separate your conductors transmits the energy. Less energy is absorbed than in coaxial cable. So it's a more efficient way to go. But, of course, you have to figure out some way to get it into your house and around corners. And coaxial cable is just so doggone easy to use that there isn't a lot of this parallel line used very much anymore, at least in my experience. Concept of standing wave ratio. And by the way, as you notice, I'm going through all the bullets on some of these and not all the bullets on some. And if you want anything explained or you're unsure about that, please let me know. Remember, you can always pull these down from the website and look at them at your leisure. You can also now, Dave is recording these presentations, so you can pull down the presentation. You can go through and you can listen to this again, providing you can stand it. Concept of standing wave ratio. If an antenna system matches the characteristic impedance of the transmitter, and these days, as I said, it's typically 52 ohms, all the power is radiated. Power traveling from the transmitter to the antenna is called forward power. If you have a mismatch, and anytime you have electromagnetic radiation going from one medium to another or from one impedance to another, anytime what it's going through changes, part of that energy will be transmitted, hopefully most of it, but part of it will be reflected. And so if your antenna is not a perfect match for your transmission line, you're going to have, such as when you are transmitting way at the edges of the range that the transmitter is designed, that the antenna is designed to work at, then you will have some of your transmitted power reflected back to your transmitter. That's not good. Different transmitters will tolerate different amounts of that. In the old vacuum tube transmitters, you could get away with a good deal more than you can now with everything with solid state power amplifiers. And the way you measure it is it's simply a ratio of the power that's actually getting into your antenna that's doing some work for you, called the forward power, to the reflected power. And in this case, we have, say we had 1.5 volts going out, 0.5 volts coming back, we would have a standing wave ratio of 3. Next slide, calculation of standing wave ratio. So visualize, the way you would do this is you'd visualize a coaxial cable with a slot all the way along its length, so that you could stick a voltmeter probe in there and slide it along the entire length of the cable while you were transmitting. Is if you recorded the highest and lowest voltages that you got, and that's what you would have. That's why it's a standing wave ratio, a standing wave, because you'd have peaks and nulls in the voltage along the line. If you recorded those and again took your ratio of the highest to the lowest, that's how you would come up with your standing wave ratio. Next slide, SWR analysis. Standing wave ratio of 1 to 1 would indicate the impedance of the antenna and its transmission line were perfectly matched. No reflection. Your highest and lowest voltage on your transmission line would be the same. So you'd have a ratio of 1. 4 to 1 would indicate an impedance mismatch, and that would be bad. You should go fix something before you pull up your transmitter, or possibly, with many of the new transceivers, they protect themselves. They monitor the SWR, and they will automatically reduce power. So if you have a really bad mismatch, you might just basically be talking to yourself in your shack. You won't be getting out anywhere. The antenna tuner is the name of this slide, and the antenna tuner is just an electronic unit that matches the impedance of, it's got two ports in the back. It's got one that goes to your transmitter and one that goes to your antenna. And the one going to your transmitter would typically be at 52 ohms. The one going to your transmitter would be at whatever wacky impedance that you happen to be at. The implication here is you're trying to use an antenna at a frequency it's not designed for. So it's going to be presenting some odd impedance, and this box will match that and transfer that power between the two. And the idea, of course, is that you can use an antenna out of range if you choose to. The balun, or balun as some people say it, it's a made-up word from the words balanced and unbalanced, and they're used a lot to convert between balanced and unbalanced feed line. The parallel line we saw a while ago with this, the thing, the two lines with the spacers, that was a balanced line, whereas coaxial cable is an unbalanced line. You have a center conductor and then the shield. The shield is at ground. Our next slide is entitled the half-wave dipole. Okay. Now, they give you the length of, here's how you calculate how long to cut the wires for the dipole. And I remember looking at this when I was 13 in 1965. I still remember that. 468 over the frequency in megahertz. A dipole is just a pair of wires. You feed it from the center. And while they say you have to use a balun, I just used a piece of 52-ohm coax, connected the shield to one side and the center conductor to the other, and away I went. So it's here, the physical length of a dipole and other antennas can be reduced without changing its resonant frequency by adding a loading coil. And if you look through ham magazines, you will see dipoles that have coils built into them so that you can use them on multiple bands. A half-wave dipole. Radiation for a dipole antenna looking down from above the antenna. Now this could, a dipole is a great antenna. It's efficient, and it's easy to make, and if you don't have a lot of money, it's a great way to go. In this diagram, the red line, the red horizontal line, represents the dipole antenna. As you can see, it's quite directional, although it's directional in two different directions. It is deaf as a stone at 90 degrees and 270. Off the ends of the antenna, it hears nothing. But broadside, it's quite good. So if you wanted to, say, talk to Europe, then you would try and string your dipole north and south, and then your energy would go east and west. Unfortunately, where I was living last, all my big trees were east and west, so all I heard was Canada and a lot of Spanish, and I didn't speak Spanish, so it didn't help me much. Very good antenna, though. Quarter wave vertical. Now, since we're doing a quarter wave, notice the number on top is cut in half, 234 over the frequency in megahertz. And you have a radiator, which is the vertical part to the left of the phrase feed point. And then you have something called radials. If you are dealing with a VHF or a UHF frequency, frequently these radials are aluminum rods that protrude horizontally from the base of the vertical radiator. If you are trying to, if you're using a vertical on HF, high frequency down below 30 megahertz, these radials would be quite long, and they would often be wires that you would bury in the ground. Now, when this series is put together, it's put together as a PowerPoint presentation so that I could click this and it would reveal the answers one by one. But we'll just kind of look at this real quick and see what we can learn. Half-wave dipole for 147 megahertz. You may remember that the formula was 468. Over the frequency in megahertz. And if you're asked these kinds of tests on these kinds of questions on the test, you can get a real quick idea that which answer is correct by, you can pretty well dope them out. For example, if you put, since we're doing a half wave, we put 468 over 147 for the top question. And how many inches would that be? Okay. We'll cheat a little bit, and we'll just round 147 up to 150. If we put 150 under 468, it's going to be a little over 3. So it's a little over 3 feet, which corresponds well to the answer here, 37 inches. Don't fall into the trap of, if they ask you for inches, don't give them feet, because I'm sure they'll have that answer there just to trick you.
George, where did the 468 come from?
Oh, I can go back if you like.
No, don't go back. Just tell me.
Oh, there's a standard formula for a half-wave antenna.
Oh.
It's 468 over the frequency in megahertz.
Okay, thanks.
And if you're doing a quarter-wave antenna, then that number is halved. It's 234 over the frequency in megahertz. So a quarter-wave antenna for 440, we'd have 440 over 234, and we would just cheat a little bit around that 234 to 220, and so that would be about 220 over 440, or half a foot, so 6 inches would be a good answer in that case. These are quite straightforward. The Yagi, this is a great antenna. I don't know what, there were all kinds of crazy antennas in amateur land before the Yagi came along, and the Yagi is just such a good antenna. It works so well, and it's quite broadband, and it's just such a good antenna that we've kind of standardized on it these days. The Yagi, you've got a feed line, a boom, which holds the whole thing together. The center element, number 2, is called the driven element, and one half of that is where all your juice goes. You bring your coax up there, you'd connect the center conductor to, say, the part just under the number 2, and you'd connect the shield to the part that points down, just below the boom. It also has 2 other elements. The one in front is slightly shorter than the driven element. That's called the director. The one behind the driven element is called the reflector, and it's slightly longer, and there are formulas for cutting these related to your driven element. And, of course, its length itself is determined by the frequency that you want to talk on. But this gives you gain, and we'll go into gain here in a little bit. But gain allows you to focus your energy in a particular direction. So it allows you to, well, if you want to talk to, if there was an interfering station near the same frequency, but he was off, say he was at 90 degrees and the guy you wanted to talk to was at 0 on the compass, if you pointed your Yagi at the guy at 0, you would hear a lot less of the noisy station at 90 degrees. Even though he's on the frequency, his signals would be attenuated, and you would probably be able to carry on a pretty good conversation and not get swamped by the other guy. I hope that made sense. A little more on the Yagi. The Yagi antenna, and heck, any beam antenna, focuses RF energy in one direction, giving the appearance of getting something for free, which you don't. The free power is called the antenna gain. You don't get any free power. If an antenna has a gain of 3 dB, and this is generally compared to something called an isotropic radiator, then the effective radiator will double. When you drop something by 3 dB, it's halved. When you increase it by 3 dB, it doubles. And many Yagis are multi-band, allowing them to operate on several bands with a single feed line. Just a word on gain. Like I said, you don't get anything for free. You don't get any extra power. Nothing magical happens. All you do is you are, in effect, putting a reflector behind your energy source, and so you are directing your power in a particular direction, and you are robbing it from power from other directions. And that's really good, because you can not only send your power out, say you're using only 100 watts or so, you can send that power out in a particular direction. So it goes, say you want to talk you've been trying to get a hold of a guy in some country to get your 100 countries work for your ARRL certificate. You could direct your Yagi at that country, and it would ignore a lot of the interference to other stations coming from off your beam direction. And the other good thing it does is it also listens in just one direction. It ignores signals coming in that are off beam, so, and especially stuff from behind you to the side. So if you have the room to put one of these things up, they're just better than sliced bread. Our next slide is the cubicle quad antenna. This was quite a popular antenna many years ago. Occasionally you'll see one, but they're pretty uncommon these days, and they're just a couple of square, or gosh, maybe they're, I think they're supposed to be square loops. I think there may be four shortened here. And you can have two or three or four stacked in a row. And they call it a cubicle quad, I guess because if you wrap the whole thing with a sheet, you'd more or less have a cube or a kind of a block in volume. Cubicle quad is two or more parallel four-sided wire loops, each approximately one electrical wavelength long. Radio wave polarization. With horizontal polarization, the lines of force of a radio wave are parallel to the Earth's surface. Okay. Vertical radiation, like a radio antenna on a car, would transmit or receive antenna in that is vertically polarized. FM radio and regular FM entertainment radio is vertically polarized. Most VHF and UHF repeater antennas use vertical polarization. And I guess most satellite operations use circular polarization. And that's an interesting item. If you want an extra homework item for next week, see if you can figure out why they use circular polarization for satellite. I'm not going to tell you. UHF, VHF antenna considerations. Okay, the rubber duck antenna that comes on your handheld, the great thing about them is they are compact and they are robust and hard to damage. The bad thing about them is that from an RF standpoint, they are absolutely atrocious antennas. They are they get out very badly, they're very inefficient. So if you can and you want to make your handheld, give it some range, there are replacement antennas you can get which you can screw on your handheld in place of the stock antenna, or you can connect it to an antenna outside your car, and that will, if you're in a car, say a mag mount, and that will help things a good deal. Ammeter. An ammeter, in order to measure current, an ammeter measures current, it has to be in series. You'd actually have to break one of the conductors in this circuit and insert and connect up these two probes to these two red wires so that all the current flows through the ammeter. In other words, the ammeter is in series with the circuit under test. A voltmeter, however, you do not break the circuit. You connect one probe to each of the two conductors, and it kind of senses, measures the potential difference, the voltage between those two guys. You do not put it in series, you put it in parallel. An ohmmeter measures the DC resistance of a load. And I think, as it says in a slide or two, you got to be real careful, because if you're using one of these guys, and I'm going pretty fast here, so I hope I'm giving you time for these slides to build, but we're looking at two multimeters. The one on the left is an old, what they used to call, I guess they still do, a VOM, a volt-ohm milliammeter. And I've got a couple of these, although mine are triplets, and this is a Simpson. They look pretty much alike. I've heard tales of people connecting up the probes to measure resistance and not noticing, not realizing that they wanted to measure voltage, not realizing they had it set for resistance, and seeing the smoke swirl around inside their meter face from cooking their meter coil. So that's a very unpopular malfunction. The one on the right, of course, is a modern digital multimeter, or DMM, and they're much more tolerant of that kind of stuff, although I still would be careful not to try and measure voltage on a a resistance setting. Meter exercise. Well, if this were a PowerPoint presentation, then what I would click this and it would reveal the answers one by one, but we don't have that luxury. So, what circuit quantity would meter A measure? Well, it is obviously its voltage because it is connected across the battery. Remember, to measure voltage, you connect your meter probes in parallel with the source, the voltage source. That'll give you the voltage. Meter B, it is in series. They have broken the wire there and connected it to the meter. So all the electricity flowing through R also has to flow through the meter. And that tells them how much current is flowing through there. Now you might worry about the current flowing through meter A and thinking, well, doesn't that throw things off? Voltmeters are very, very high impedance. They just sip a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of current. So except in a very, very sensitive circuit, the amount of current that you would draw by connecting up your voltmeter when you had your ammeter on there would not skew your results too badly. Okay, power. Power is measured in watts. Right, Desiree?
Yes.
Okay. Power is measured in watts. And here's the formula for power. W, watts, equals E, voltage, times I. The French got to this stuff before we did. I stands for intensité. I don't remember what E stands for, but so we just have to put up with that. W equals E times I. But also remember that Ohm's law states that E is equal to I times R. So we can substitute I times R for the E in this power formula, and we come up with W equals I times R times I equals, ignore that center term, that's wrong. 2 times I. It's I times I, not 2 times I. Anyway, W equals I times R times I, or R times I times I, or R times I squared, or I squared R is what it's usually termed. I squared R is power. Okay. And I got a quick mnemonic for you. If you have trouble remembering Ohm's law, if you can remember E equals IR, think of what my old electronics professor told me many years ago. The eagle sees the Indian and the rabbit. So if you want to change E equals IR into I equals E over R or R equals E over I, if you're a little rusty on your algebra, you can remember the eagle sees the Indian and the rabbit, E equals IR. The Indian sees the eagle over the rabbit, I equals E over R. And the rabbit sees the eagle over the Indian, R equals E over I. Soldering safety. When using a soldering gun, keep in mind the following safety considerations. Okay, a soldering gun gets really hot. Well, yeah, it melts metal. Make sure no one touches it for at least 10 minutes after turning it off. Many people used to use the old soldering irons, which were these big, heavy, like a big screwdriver with a wire coming out of the handle. Most people use guns these days, and they heat down pretty fast. But still, you don't want to intentionally hurt yourself. Wear safety glasses. Occasionally molten solder will splash. Well, yeah, don't drink it either. Solder in a well-ventilated area. Of these, this one is the one that I would take the very most seriously. Solder contains some very heavy metals like lead and tin and maybe antimony. And there's some of that in the fumes, so avoid breathing the smoke if you can avoid it, if you can help it. Basic troubleshooting. If a rig works in a car where it's connected to the battery, but not in the house where it's connected up to a power supply, you might logically conclude that your power supply isn't putting out anything, so that would be what to check first. If a mobile transceiver, does not power up, check the fuses. Since you don't have a power supply in the car, maybe something has popped, so check the fuses and supply the juice from the battery. If you suspect that the supply voltage to a rig is low, check the voltage with the voltmeter at the 12-volt plug in the rig rather than at the power supply or battery, because if there's something wrong with the cables connecting the battery to the power supply, you might get a very low voltage or no voltage at all at your rig. More basic troubleshooting. If AC hum is reported in a transmitter's RF signal, additional filtering of the power supply may be required. AC hum, 60-cycle hum, is a frequency that you can hear. So if you hear that, then there may be something going wrong with your power supply, or you may need to replace it. Stray noise and RF pickup may be reduced by providing adequate DC source supply filtering for a mobile transceiver. Signal generator produces a stable low-level signal that can be set to a specific frequency and may be useful for checking receiver. Okay, yeah, signal generator is a handy test item to have around your bench. By the way, the stray noise and RF pickup, the worst, if you have a rig in your car, the very worst time is a winter evening when you have the wiper, and it's raining, you have the wipers on, the headlights on, the heater on, and you're drawing a lot of juice from your alternator. Cars have alternators, which are an AC generator, and that's rectified to DC. It's a much more efficient way to produce electricity than the old generators, but it also means that when you're really pulling a lot of juice out of the alternator, sometimes the you can get some AC component in there along with the DC, and that you'll hear it. You'll hear it, it's a whine that follows the engine speed. So if you're sitting in a light and you race your engine, you hear in the background of your rig, you hear a ooh, then you're getting some AC in there. And there's some things you can do about that with capacitors and so forth. And that's fairly straightforward to fix. Okay, for chapter four, for lesson four rather, the train has just entered the station. So you've successfully come through 4/5 of your technician training. For next week, study sub-element T8 of the question pool. Read the question and answer 3 times. Read chapter 8, now you're talking. And if you're interested, check and see why they use circular polarization with satellites. If anybody has a question, I'll be happy to answer. Otherwise, we're done.
George, thank you very much. I don't know enough to ask a question. I'll pass on asking a question, but I really appreciate your giving us the lesson. Thank you so much.
Very good. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
George, did you give them homework?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I even asked a bonus question. I asked them to figure out, if they could, why they use circular polarization to work satellites.
Very good. And by the way, I'm one of those perfectionists who uses open wire feed lines.
Are you really?
Yeah. Like you said, they're very efficient. You don't have to worry about the sunlight getting to them.
Oh, well, you must have quite a shack.
Well, it's out down in the boondocks in the country, but they do a good job. But you just have to have room for the tuners.
Yeah, and you have to have feed-throughs and what have you.
Yep. Oh, yeah. We'd like to go to the Ham Fest and collect the old 4-inch insulators so we can feed them through the barn.
Anybody else have a question? I see we've still got a few people hanging on.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lot of information, my boys are going to figure out what the polarization question is all about.
Well, good. I'll be listening in next week and see what you guys come up with. Thank you for being here tonight.
All right. Well, thank you for your time.
All right.
Thanks, George. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, George. Good evening, everybody.
Thank you, Dave. Bye-bye.